Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Gadalska. The GOP spending bill that's now law is throwing a curveball at state lawmakers. Kickbacks to Wyoming from the coal industry are a lot less now.
I know that was not the intent.
Could you really defend yourself against a grizzly with bear spray? Some people found out when they practiced spraying a robo-bear.
The whole goal is that by the time that this is out of its holster, all you're doing is pointing and spraying.
Effie Warren Base in Cheyenne will be the first to modernize its nuclear missiles under the Sentinel program. It means the Air Force will ask landowners for easements.
You know, we're putting a missile next to your house. It's going to devalue your land, and there really isn't that much you can do about it.
Those stories and more. Stay with us. This is Open Spaces.
Hey, Gillette. Join Wyoming Public Media reporters for some coffee and conversations. If you're in the area, come share feedback, give us a news tip, and get to know us. Join us from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. on Wednesday, September 24th at City Brew Coffee.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Gadalska. Among the many things included in the GOP spending bill, signed into law in July, was a break to the coal industry. The idea is to ramp up coal production, so companies will pay the federal government lower fees for mining coal on public lands. Here's the thing, though. Those fees go to both the federal government and states, and in the top producing coal state in the country, less coal revenue could mean a sizable financial hit. Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan has that one.
To understand why Wyoming lawmakers are actually not that excited about some of the GOP spending bill, we have to take a second to remember just how important coal is to the state.
Come along for a visit to a land where coal is king.
That's from a 2007 documentary from Pentrex Train Videos, back when coal was at its peak. Over the last 50 years, the state of Wyoming made bank from coal, billions of dollars to fund things like the government, schools, roads, parks. The state even has its own sovereign wealth fund, thanks to coal.
If you visit here, you're certain to see hundreds of coal trains, as we did.
Here's how it works. When coal is mined on federal land, the mining company pays fees, or royalties. Half of those royalties go to the federal government, and the other half goes to the state. And only Congress has the power to change that ratio. And President Trump's GOP policy bill lowers those royalty fees for mining companies. State economist Dylan Boehner says that might be a great deal for coal companies.
On the surface, sounds great for Wyoming, but in the way that it is being done, is going to negatively impact our revenues.
The royalty rate was slashed almost in half. President Trump's ideas to make it easier and cheaper for companies to mine coal.
The goal of this bill is to try to incentivize people to produce and, you know, as he said, drill, baby, drill.
But the loss to Wyoming's state budget is an estimated $50 million a year. That's a bit shy of 10% of what Wyoming makes each year off federal minerals like oil, gas, and coal.
I know that was not the intent.
That's Evanston Representative Robert Wharf.
Everybody said how this is such a great thing for our state.
In a state that had the highest margin of votes for Trump's presidency, there's big support for his vision to prop up the coal industry, but a lot of uncertainty that this is the way to do it. Demand for Wyoming's coal has been dropping for well over 15 years. GOP congressional members say the lower rates will help revitalize the declining industry, but local lawmakers, like Wharf, worry that shift could take time.
If it's going to take us multiple years to see that, I don't know.
So Wharf and his colleagues are trying to get creative to offset that $50 million loss in annual state revenue. Casper Representative Bob Ide points to Alaska. It gets a bigger share of royalty fees for oil and gas.
Alaska actually has a 90-10 split, and they got that in its statehood.
Ide is hoping Wyoming can ask Congress to give his state a better deal. But any legislation is months out. Ide also brought up his ideal solution.
We looked at a federal land transfer, which would solve all of those problems.
Wyoming has been trying to get a hold of federal land and those mineral rights for years, long before the public land sell-off proposal from earlier this summer. But it's never been successful. In the meantime, Dylan Boehner, the state economist, says the GOP spending bill could lead to an increase in coal production. Just recently, mine expansions were approved in Campbell County's West Antelope 3 and Sweetwater County's Black Butte. And that could be a good thing for those mining communities.
That would lead to maybe a ripple effect in terms of restaurant activity, lodging activity, stuff like that, retail activity.
Trump is hoping to reopen land to new coal leasing, like in northeast Wyoming's Powder River Basin, bringing the area back to its former production heyday, like in the Pentrex documentary.
It won't be long before this coal will be extracted and loaded aboard trains.
But will the market support it? And would an increase in coal production offset the state's revenue loss?
Oh, that's a lot of coal.
Some economists and lawmakers aren't so sure. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Caitlin Tan.
Property tax cuts, reductions to Medicaid, and the repeal of gun-free zones affect each community in Wyoming differently. With those issues in mind, and the next legislative session on the horizon, state government reporter Chris Clements will be hitting the road. Over the course of 4 days, he'll be listening to Wyomingites' concerns in the northeast corner of the Equality State. Thanks for joining me, Chris.
It's a great day to talk about state government, Camila.
Indeed. So let's dive straight in. Where are you going and why?
I'll be spending time in Gillette, Devil's Tower, Hewlett, and Sundance. The whole idea is to take folks' temperature on a host of different issues. As you mentioned, I'll be asking about specific things like property tax and gun-free zones, but I'll also ask people questions that are broader, like how they feel about the direction the state is heading in and what they'd like to see their state leaders do differently. Also, I want to know about how changes to how towns and cities receive mineral royalties could be impacting revenues. Those are just a few of the questions on my list. The whole idea is for people in the northeast quadrant of Wyoming to be heard.
And you'll be heading to grocery stores, laundromats, and post offices in those communities to do your interviews, right?
That's correct. So if you live in any of those towns, there's a decent chance you'll see me sometime from September 22nd to the 24th. I'll be the tall, bespectacled dude with an odd-looking, fluffy microphone wandering around your public spaces. If you see me, please come say hello.
Yes, that microphone is an invitation to say hi.
Absolutely.
So besides Wyomingites in general, do you have any plans to interview specific people?
Yeah, I'll be meeting up with Gillette Representative John Baer in his town and visiting Devil's Tower Senator Ogden Driscoll at his ranch. Baer is a former chair of the Further Right Wyoming Freedom Caucus, and Driscoll is a former president of the Senate who some lawmakers have said is too moderate. I have a few other lawmakers I'm hoping will agree to talk with me too.
Nice. So we're going to hear all about your adventures live on All Things Considered on Tuesday afternoon around 4:44. And you've got some future stories lined up that will be based on your trip.
Exactamundo, Camila.
Great. Well, I can't wait to hear more about your road trip. Thanks for talking with me, Chris.
Of course. Catch you on the flippy flop.
September is National Suicide Prevention Month, and Wyoming has one of the highest suicide rates in the country. It's also home to one of the largest populations of veterans who are at a higher risk of taking their own lives than civilians. But a statewide program called Veterans Talking to Veterans is working to change that. It trains veterans and their spouses to be trauma-informed coaches, who then support their peers at weekly meetings around the state. Governor Mark Gordon spotlighted the program in a recent newsletter, writing that it, quote, exemplifies the best of Wyoming's values, service, resilience, and community, unquote. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman brings us a closer look.
I'm Hannah. Nice to meet you. How's it going?
Good. In a church basement in Pinedale, Chris Searles is getting ready for tonight's meeting.
We have this space that the local community can come in and be part of the organization.
The meeting is hybrid. There's a big projector set up for folks who'll be zooming in, sometimes from all over the country.
I've had Alaska to Rhode Island to Texas calling. And that same day, I had Vietnam vets all the way down to a 25-year-old Marine.
The meetings aren't about swapping war stories. They're conversations guided by coaches like Searles with questions based on things like movies or music.
Your perspective from whatever, Metallica, The Day That Never Comes, is going to be completely different from mine. And I'm going to now appreciate her perspective. I'm like, man, I never would have thought of it that way.
Searles joined the Army after 9/11, a fourth-generation combat soldier. But on one of his deployments, almost everyone on his team was killed.
I was in a different truck. My truck got hit the day before we were going home. True story. And the driver lived, everybody else was killed instantly.
Searles came back after that, moved to Pinedale, built a house with his wife, joined the local search and rescue team. But he had so much rage.
I had to leave search and rescue because of it. I was so angry.
He felt like he wasn't being a good dad. So he went away, did some work on himself, and came back to Wyoming.
The Veterans Talking to Veterans program started coming around, and I jumped on board because I wanted to go help people, and I was fed up with the suicide.
Searles says we need to figure out how to process trauma and do it in community.
So that's our job as the coach, is to turn it from post-traumatic stress into post-traumatic growth. How do you grow from that trauma?
Cue Julie Ellidge. She's a trauma-informed therapist, coach, and trainer based in Jackson.
The storytelling, in my opinion, is the answer of how we cope with trauma, how we unravel it and make meaning.
Ellidge grew up in a military family. She started Veterans Talking to Veterans in 2020, the day the U.S. pulled out of Afghanistan.
By 9 o'clock in the morning, I had had three people I had trained call me to say that they had stopped a veteran from suicide.
She immediately called up Tim Shepard, the Wyoming Veterans Commissioner. Together, they got the ball rolling.
Even our training is really transformational. So when the coach gets out, they are just burning with desire to get out and engage with it and to share it.
The program's now graduated three cohorts with about 50 coaches around the state. Each meeting draws about a dozen people.
We want at least one coach in every rural community. And then there's, you know, we don't want to ignore the cities either.
70% of people in the world go through some sort of potentially traumatic experience, according to the World Health Organization. Ellidge says there needs to be more non-clinical solutions to process trauma.
And as a coach, we're not trying to replace therapy. We're in addition to.
One of the big goals of the program is to help veterans change their own narrative.
If you put a broken mirror in front of people, they will believe that mirror. I believe that we need to be focusing on veterans' potential.
George DeBono was working as a primary prevention specialist for the Wyoming Military Department in Cheyenne when he first heard about Veterans Talking to Veterans.
So I sat in on the group meeting, I shared, and then I kept coming back. I think I did that 3 or 4 months or something like that.
DeBono says it was people working together, community.
Not someone telling me, well, you're messed up and you need to do this and this, X, Y, and Z. It wasn't nothing like that.
He liked it so much, he decided to become a coach too.
I'm not going to fix you. I don't have the answers, but I can help walk alongside you with it and see where we go.
The program got its start in Wyoming, but it's now expanded to Idaho. And DeBono is helping mentor new coaches in Rhode Island and New Mexico. His dream is to get it in all 50 states.
Trauma takes away your voice and choice. And if we got a lot more people out there helping with that, we'll have a better, thriving veteran community.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Haberman.
Do you know how to use bear spray? Some folks learn with the help of a robo-bear. That's up next on Open Spaces.
This time on Human Nature, a woman leaves her old life behind to find herself on the trail.
I think quitting was always at the forefront of my mind. I mean, there were many days that I truly wanted to quit and believed I was going to quit. And I'm not really sure what it was that kind of kept me going, but a lot of it was just wanting to prove everyone else and myself wrong.
Find Human Nature on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or our website, humannaturepodcast.org. That's Human Nature, one word, one N.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. This month, a grizzly bear attacked a hiker in Yellowstone National Park. He was able to walk out and get medical care, but states are trying to prevent grizzlier encounters. They've stepped in to help manage the iconic but federally threatened species, as well as the people on the landscape. As Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Merzbach reports, one solution involves a robo-bear.
About 100 residents and visitors are waiting eagerly in a parking lot in Jackson, Wyoming, the gateway to Grand Teton National Park, which is home to many grizzlies. They're here to save $50 and get a free can of bear spray, the most popular way to fend off a bear. But first, they have to practice using it.
Aim right at the bear's face, maybe slightly downward.
Wyoming Game and Fish employees wearing their signature bright red polos hand out cans of practice spray.
Okay, you're up. All right, thank you.
There's a mobile plastic grizzly the size of a cub. Employee Mark Otten drives it to the end of the parking lot with a remote control, like a toy car.
All right, so I'll have you guys line up.
Five people at a time, they face away from the grizzly gripping their spray. Then Otten accelerates the robo-bear toward them, teeth bared.
Bear, bear, bear.
They whip around, throw off the safety, and try to pull the trigger. A few successfully discharge the spray in time. It smells like nail polish remover, unlike the real stuff, which, if it gets in your face, feels like hot peppers being stuffed in your nose and leaves most people crying on the ground.
It's just a huge benefit to have this, like, physical, tangible, you know, metric of like, oh, I'm totally not prepared, or oh, I did all right.
About half of Otten's job is teaching people how to stay out of trouble. He spends the other half dealing with conflicts.
We're going to be a lot more lenient with a bear that has maybe found a bit of bird seed that was unattended away from a house versus a bear that has tried to break into a shed.
They try to catch the bears on their first offense before they're too used to humans and their food. Sometimes they relocate the bears. Other times they're too late and decide to euthanize them.
I think we're living in coexistence right now.
That's Otten's boss, Dan Thompson.
Where we have a lot of bears and a lot of people, and that increases a lot of conflict potential. So we're trying to do things and reduce that as much as possible.
The National Park Service says the chances of being injured by a grizzly in a place like Yellowstone are about 1 in 3 million. Bears are more likely to end up hurt. More than 50 grizzlies have died this year in the area, many hit by cars or put down for attacking livestock. But Thompson says the population still has healthy numbers. In its recovery since being listed on the endangered species list in 1975 is a success story. Yet it remains on the list.
Being stuck in the suspended animation doesn't allow you to finish the story.
Many environmentalists want to see grizzlies stay federally protected, since they only occupy a slice of their historic range. But the state of Wyoming, Montana, and Idaho want them delisted. That could mean starting up hunting seasons and complete state management, which Thompson says is pretty much already happening.
We're doing all the work on the ground now.
Responding to conflicts, reducing attractants like trash and bird feeders, and educating the public on how to keep the bears at bay. That includes people like Otten.
The whole goal is that by the time that this is out of its holster, all you're doing is pointing and spraying.
The event's wrapping up, and Otten's giving some extra tips to some of the people lingering around the robo-bear.
Do you have a nickname for the robo-bear?
I don't. I just call it robo-bear. I've heard kids sometimes will call it Roberto, but that's the only one I've heard.
With that, Otten loads his trusty colleague Roberto into a trailer. The bear's got a busy schedule charging people around the state. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Merzbach in Jackson.
A majority of farms in the United States are considered small. In Wyoming, most farms fit that bill. For some in our region, it's becoming increasingly more difficult to keep going. For the Mountain West News Bureau, Lucia Starbuck has the story of a difficult harvest in rural northern Nevada.
Pickling cucumber, onion on this patch here. Here on the right, that's actually tomatillo.
It's already a hot and dry desert morning in Fallon. The pickup truck kicks up dirt and dust as we drive alongside a sea of leafy produce sprouting from the ground. Four generations of the Alanese family have cared for the land. I'm with Adrian Alanese Rios, his son Cuco, who you just heard from, and his grandson Adrian. Alanese Rios has grown a variety of crops for 40 years, but it all started with his father.
My dad is got his bicycle and his hoe and came here to town and going and knocked the door and say, I can clean in all the weeds. And heaven is not talk English. And the people say, hey, how much? And him is right in the ground. One day, he stopped here and he talked to the boss. Hey, I'm looking for work and stay here for the rest of the years.
The family is from Guanajuato, Mexico. Alanese Rios' father came to the U.S. in 1957. It's common for a small family farm to have a deeply rooted backstory, says Ruth Dahlquist Willard. She's with the University of California Agriculture and Natural Resources.
Often a smaller family farm has a unique story to tell, maybe going back several generations, or maybe a story of immigration and adapting to a new place.
As the sun beats down on us, Cuco shows off the other produce they're growing, including Fallon's prized possession, Hearts of Gold cantaloupe.
It's their taste of flavor. It's really unique. You bite into it, it's like a sweet, it tingles. It's different, and people like it.
As you look out on the 500 acres of land, there's no heavy machinery to be seen. Farm workers pick everything by hand. But federal cuts have put all that hard work in jeopardy. Melons are rotting in the field. Usually, these would be heading to the food bank through the state-run Home Feeds Nevada program, which bought the produce from the family. It was a steady source of income for them. They had no idea the program would come to an end and began planting this year's crops back in December. But the USDA ended the funding in March. Now the family relies on sales from the Latin Farm storefront, from the back of their pickup truck, and the annual Fallon Cantaloupe Festival. But there is just too much fruit to sell.
You already have your plants growing, you have everything planned out. Money investment, it feels bad. It feels like someone just pokes you right in the gut.
Cuco shows me a refrigerated trailer with 8 pallet-sized boxes of the sweet-smelling melons. That's in addition to 8 acres of ripe cantaloupes ready to be picked from the vine. To help farmers like the Alanese family, the state approved $800,000, but it's just a drop in the bucket and hasn't been distributed yet. Bill Knudsen is an agricultural economist at Michigan State University. He says federal assistance not only helps support smaller farmers, but also creates stronger rural communities.
It's sometimes easier to supply local food banks and food pantries with produce from smaller farmers rather than trying to work with some of the bigger agri-food firms and farms that are out there.
Besides federal funding cuts, small farms face numerous challenges, says Dahlquist Willard. This includes creating a sustainable business model, transportation, and climate change.
There might be less reliable rainfall or snowfall, or it might be warmer rain that causes more floods. Small farms tend to be more vulnerable. They might not have as much capital or infrastructure to deal with disasters.
The Alanese family says it's something they're not going to give up, even though it's a gamble and it's unpredictable.
This is our peaceful area. Like I say, when we're stressed out, things are bad out in the fields. Just come out in the middle, sit down with those big shade trees. See those? Sit down, relax, and just it's really peaceful to work outside. And farming for us is our thing.
They're already looking toward the next season. This fall, the rows of corn will transform into a maze that draws large crowds. And Cuco and his family will be right there to greet them. Lucia Starbuck, KUNR News, Fallon.
The Department of Defense is modernizing its nuclear missiles, starting at the F.E. Warren Air Force Base in Cheyenne. We learn more on Open Spaces.
This time on The Modern West, an extended conversation with the Buffalo Bulletin's husband and wife news team about why they rescued 8 Wyoming newspapers from getting shut down.
You know, a lot of these newspapers have operated in their communities since before their communities were incorporated. There's a tradition. I think the tradition matters.
It's part one of a pair of bonus episodes on Wyoming's news ecosystem. Find them under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadelska. As the U.S. modernizes its nuclear arsenal, Wyoming will play a role in the new Sentinel nuclear missile program. All existing nuclear warheads will be replaced with new ones, and F.E. Warren Base in Cheyenne is the first to be modernized.
In many ways, like, Wyoming is kind of the guinea pig here because there's going to be a lot of lessons learned from this process that are then, in theory, going to be transferred down to Montana and then to North Dakota.
Matt Korda is the Associate Director for the Nuclear Information Project at the Federation of American Scientists. He's been tracking this new Sentinel program and what it means for Wyoming. So I'm eager to pick your brain about nuclear weapons in Wyoming. But first, let's get some context. You are one of the authors of the Nuclear Notebook, which puts together estimates of nuclear forces and trends around the globe. What's the big picture from this year so far?
All nuclear-armed countries, all nine countries with nuclear weapons, are currently modernizing their nuclear arsenals. And what do I mean by modernizing? I mean that either they are qualitatively improving the types of weapons that they have, or they're quantitatively increasing the number of nuclear weapons in their stockpile.
Wyoming has played a role in the nation's nuclear weapons program almost since the beginning. Can you give us some context of what the role of the F.E. Warren Air Force Base in Cheyenne has?
Wyoming is really at the heart of the United States's land-based nuclear missile component of the triad, right? The U.S. refers to its nuclear weapons as composing part of this triad of land, air, and sea. Wyoming plays a really big role in the land-based part of that that program because there are 150 silos that are deployed, you know, around the F.E. Warren Air Force Base.
And what is a silo?
It's a big hole in the ground where missiles, which carry nuclear weapons, are placed into. And so these are something that the U.S. has had in its arsenal for the past, you know, 50, 60 years. And this modernization program that the U.S. is embarking on is going to have them for the next 50, 60 years as well.
The United States modernization effort, as I understand, it's from the new Sentinel nuclear missile program. Wyoming, along with Montana, North Dakota, Utah, and Arizona, will get new intercontinental ballistic missiles, or ICBMs, or provide support. Where is the project currently?
Where we're at right now is this program has been in progress now for the past, like, maybe like 15 years or so. And this is kind of just the nature of nuclear weapons programs, is they take a really long time to build. Where we're at right now with the Sentinel is really challenging, right? And it sort of seems like every month we get this kind of new update as to how the missile program is either behind schedule or over budget. Or there's some other sort of thing that's happening, right? Whether it's relating to mismanagement of the program, sort of poor contractor performance, that sort of thing. This has created a lot of problems, right? Because the initial plan for this program was to reuse a lot of the old silo infrastructure, right? There's already been a ton of construction that was done, like, during the 70s to build all of these different silos and place them into these various states. So the hope was to save as much money as possible and just reuse a lot of that infrastructure and then just put a new missile into the same silo. What the Air Force is now finding is that this is basically impossible. This program was sort of accelerated in many ways, but before the analysis was kind of fully baked. And so what's happened now is acquisition costs of the program have now risen to 81% over the baseline.
Wow.
Right? So the original acquisition costs were supposed to be somewhere in the realm of about $77 billion in 2020 dollars. Now we're at about 140. And what's happened is that that has triggered a breach of what's called the Nunn-McCurdy Act, which is this act in Congress that says you're not supposed to go 25% over budget. And then if you do go 25% over budget, then the program basically has to be scrutinized really heavily by the Department of Defense. There's a lot of work that has to be done to change things.
Right.
And so we're seeing that there's going to be a lot more construction than originally planned because these various pieces of the silo that they thought they could reuse, they can't reuse anymore. What this means is that some of these costs are going to trickle down to taxpayers, right? In addition, there are challenges with landowners, right? Because what was originally not foreseen was that the plan was originally that the Air Force was going to just use the same kind of cabling that already exists underground for the new silos. Now that that's not possible, they have to go and dig new holes, new passageways for the cabling. This is going to require more land that gets leased to the Air Force by local farmers and ranchers and other folks who own that land. So the Air Force is sort of preparing to go around to these different folks who own this land and basically offer to buy it. And it's likely going to be that the landowners probably have no choice but to sell to the Air Force, because this is the land that the Air Force needs for this missile program. And historically, that's how it's worked.
What's going to come to Wyoming as a result of this project?
So in terms of the construction, there's going to be a lot of on-base construction at F.E. Warren. They're producing a lot of buildings and things like that, new facilities that are meant to help test out the new system, that sort of thing. There's going to be a lot of construction off-base as well.
Mm.
So I mentioned that there's going to be these new easements that are required for the new cabling. That means that folks are going to have to sell their land to the Air Force to allow the Air Force to come in and add new fiber optic cabling underground, that sort of thing. In addition, we're going to see a lot of sort of these new construction camps that pop up in the area. They're going to be sort of, there's a bunch of small ones that are coming, and there's going to be one big one coming to Kimball, Nebraska, which is quite close by. So that new workforce hub is going to have approximately 2,500 to 3,000 people that are going to be added into the community. What's really interesting is that the Air Force, they completed what's called an environmental impact statement. They talk about, you know, how the program is going to impact the local ground squirrel population and all these things. But what they also do is they talk about how it's going to impact local communities.
Mm.
And they have all these statistics on how adding this kind of influx of folks into the area is going to impact things like housing costs, rental costs, crime rates, noise, things like that,
wow,
right? Like
okay.
It kind of goes down the list, and they talk about, you know, the statement itself notes that there's likely to be adverse effects to things like socioeconomics, because folks are going to come into the community and public schools will be, you know, even more in demand, right? So there's like things like that that do tend to get affected when you have these sort of major construction projects.
Do we know the timeline?
So the plans are for about 3 to 5 years. The starting time, it's already kind of starting.
And you mentioned, so the construction site in Kimball, which is about 20 miles from the Wyoming border and about 40 miles from Cheyenne, and that could cause, you know, these local impacts like housing and crime issues potentially. How much say will the state or local communities have?
In some ways, not a ton, right? This project is, the way it's sort of described is that it's sort of too big to fail. A lot of money has already been sunk into it. It's really challenging to sort of push back against that. And it's even challenging to even ask questions, I think, that are very reasonable about, like, why we are so over budget, right? Why are we so behind schedule? Why are landowners going to have these impacts to them that they didn't anticipate, right? Like, those type of questions, I think, are really valid. And it's tough to even get concrete answers about those things. What's historically happened is that, you know, when the Air Force was figuring out where to base their missiles back in the 60s, local landowners did not really have a ton of say in where those missiles would be placed. It did create quite a bit of tension, right, between local landowners who, in many ways, are actually quite supportive of the military and quite supportive of the nuclear complex, but did resent the fact that there was kind of this, like, faceless bureaucracy that would come down and say, you know, we're putting a missile next to your house, it's going to devalue your land, and there really isn't that much you can do about it. There are ways right now in which local residents can sort of engage with the Air Force, and they've set up kind of a hotline, and there were these public town halls and things like that for folks to go and ask their questions. These are all, you know, public record, and so we can see sort of the types of concerns that people have had. The big question is, are those concerns going to be taken into account? At least historically, they really weren't, right? Like, there was at least, you know, there's one anecdotal instance in which the Air Force back, like, in the 60s, sighted a missile silo within spitting distance of someone's house. And then when that family complained, the Air Force said, okay, then move, right? We're not moving our missile. You have to move instead. I would hope that maybe there's some lessons learned from that this time around, but it's hard to know exactly how the process will go. What we do know is that they've already begun to engage with local landowners, right? So a letter was sent out from the Air Force to folks in the area surrounding F.E. Warren as recently as May of this year. And it basically said, like, hey, we are about to start this process, right, for the conversion of these silos. This is going to involve us acquiring more easements. And so we will be in touch shortly about, like, how to evaluate your land, and we will try and offer you fair market rate and that sort of thing.
And you mentioned that there has been some public meetings and some concerns were raised. Do you know what those concerns were?
Yeah, so you can sort of bundle them into a few different categories, okay. Right? Some are just folks, you know, writing in and saying, I live nearby and I just want to stay informed. You'll have some folks who are saying, you know, I'd really prefer that you don't build on my land. There's some much better land over there, you know, my neighbor's land, you can build over there instead. There are folks, you know, who are writing in who have legitimate questions and concerns about the ecology in the area. And they're saying, you know, there are endangered plants and animals and trees and things like that. Is the construction going to disrupt those ecosystems? The Air Force has stated through their environmental impact statement that it will disrupt some of those endangered species. And so people have, I think, a lot of very fair questions about that. And then there's other people who are writing in who are saying, you know, I support this project. I want to learn more about it. How can I help? Right. So it's actually it's a really wide range of things.
What do you see as the benefits and downsides of this program?
So one is that in terms of, I guess, like the benefits of this program, it fits what the U.S. deterrence strategy is right now, right? When you think about what nuclear weapons are for, you can really sort of fall into a couple different camps here. One is just that the mere presence of nuclear weapons is enough to make your adversaries think twice about wanting to launch at you. And so in that sense, if you only have a couple hundred nuclear weapons, that's probably enough. The U.S. has historically taken a really different approach to nuclear weapons. Their idea has been more about damage limitation, right? So in the event of a nuclear crisis, the U.S. has all of these ICBMs, right? These intercontinental ballistic missiles that are deployed across these states to be able to hit another country with so much firepower that it will limit the damage coming back to the United States. And so it really sort of comes down to like how you think about what nuclear weapons are for as to whether or not this program is a good idea or whether it's an unnecessary public expense. In terms of the downsides of the program, I can see a few, right? So one is clearly the additional construction and cost is absolutely going to affect local folks, local community members, ranchers, farmers, landowners, that sort of thing. And the costs will be borne by Americans all across the country. Another thing is that by having ICBMs in these areas, it makes you a target. The point of these ICBMs is there, right? Like, yes, they're there to launch in a crisis and have this damage limitation mission. But they're also there to be shot at with nuclear weapons. And so if you are someone who lives in the state of Wyoming, whether you like it or not, you are a target. And you are essentially the first target for a nuclear attack. That, I think, sort of puts your relationship with maybe the military and with the United States like government and thinking about what role you have. It raises, I think, significant questions, right, as to whether or not that's the type of role that you want to have in relation to your government. And I think what's particularly interesting is that the ICBM force, right, this land-based missile force, this is the only part of the nuclear triad that exists among the American population, right? The submarines, you know, these are, for the most part, relatively isolated. You know, there's two ports. The bomber bases, you know, these are like their own enclosed things. The silos, you can like walk up to them, right? They are on people's lands. They are dotted around the country. People live among them. And I think that's something that people deserve to really think quite critically about and be empowered with the information to sort of assess this for themselves as to whether or not that's something that they want.
That was Matt Korda with the Nuclear Information Project speaking about the modernization of the nation's nuclear arms, including here in Wyoming. More communities and parks in the Mountain West are trying to limit light pollution. We'll find out why coming up on Open Spaces.
Want to do more than just listen to Wyoming Public Radio? You can help us through our new volunteer platform. We're looking for a few folks to pick up court documents, take photos, and promote local events. sign up with the volunteer button at the top of our website. We depend on you as much as you rely on us.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Our region has one of the highest concentrations of places dedicated to preserving the night sky. The Mountain West News Bureau's Rachel Cohen reports on why more communities are choosing to dim the lights.
Twilight seems to go on forever at this mountain lake where about 20 people are patiently waiting for the stars. But as the sky settles into a crisp navy, tiny white dots begin to reveal themselves.
We're ready for the telescope, so if you guys want to line up right here.
Leo Peretti and Joan Vair are Forest Service Rangers leading the star party in Twin Lakes outside of Leadville, Colorado.
So the Big Dipper has just poked out a little bit, and we're going to have to really crane our necks.
Oh, wow.
The sky could soon get even darker around here because there's an effort underway to reduce the glow coming from streetlights and storefronts in town. Leadville's leaders are applying for a certification that says it's committed to limiting light pollution. It's through the nonprofit Dark Sky International, where Michael Reimer works.
We are using light excessively and incorrectly where we live and work.
He says 4 out of 5 people living in the U.S. now can't see the Milky Way, but more than 200 places have joined Dark Sky's effort.
We are not trying to get rid of all light altogether. We're trying to use light more responsibly.
The Mountain West plays a big role. Flagstaff, Arizona became the first ever dark sky community in 2001. Central Idaho is home to the only dark sky reserve in the U.S., and Utah has the highest concentration of dark sky places globally. Adam Ducharme is in charge of tourism for Leadville, the highest elevation city in the U.S.
People are naturally drawn to this place because of our access to the outdoors.
Compared to ritzy ski destinations nearby, Leadville is more of a working town with an economy historically driven by mining. But people flock here to climb the highest peaks in the state and for a grueling ultra trail race. Ducharme thinks adding a dark sky badge will help attract more visitors, ones who value conservation.
So rather than just sort of trying to pave paradise and put up a parking lot, it's, you know, a lot more about, hey, we are Leadville Twin Lakes and come experience the beauty of this place.
The state of Colorado shares this vision. It's making a big push to get more communities and state parks on board. It's helping them with the dark sky application process, which can take years. That's why on a chilly evening this past spring, Ben Benet is holding a sensor below a lamppost in Leadville.
We can just point this out, press the button, 4100 CCT.
He's the town's dark sky mentor, paired by the state. Benet is walking volunteers through a lighting inventory. It's a catalog of all the public outdoor lights. Collecting this data will tell Leadville how much work it has to do to reach compliance.
Looking at like the number of light fixtures, we probably don't need 3 lights on that one pole.
Those steps are outlined in an ordinance, which the city will need to pass for the certification. Leadville is small, only 1 square mile, and outside city limits are brighter lights, like ski resorts and a mine. Reimer from Dark Sky International says growth can affect places already certified by the organization.
Because there's development around those places that is really outpacing the work in reducing light pollution.
Still, Leadville's efforts could help illuminate the stars for campers nearby.
This is pretty spectacular.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stars out.
Back at the star party in Twin Lakes, Bruce Hicks and his wife Beth say they made their way to Colorado in an RV from Florida. Other stargazers are from Illinois and Texas. The Hicks seek out wild places like this.
The light pollution is so low that we see so much more than we do at home.
They're exactly the type of people Colorado wants to attract. And maybe when they return home, they'll spread the message about protecting the night skies. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Rachel Cohen.
Stephen Horn says the key to a good fiction thriller is exploring a real-life issue, with a lot of tension. Horn is the author behind the award-winning Sam Dawson mystery series and just published the sixth part, Lost and Found Cafe. Horn is a wildlife biologist by training and spent years working in conservation and agriculture in Colorado and Wyoming before publishing his stories. He spoke with Wyoming Public Media's program director, Grady Kirkpatrick, about his latest book.
Welcome, Mr. Horn, and I wanted to first ask you a little bit about your background. You're originally from Iowa, correct?
That's true. Eastern Iowa, but left home a long time ago.
What initially inspired you to write?
Well, I've always written. I enjoyed writing even clear back in high school, but I never thought about publishing. I just enjoyed writing. I had a number of things that I used to write on a regular basis when I was dean here, College of Agriculture Publications, people seemed to enjoy, where you would blend fact and story to get people's attention about issues. And after I retired, I decided I might want to try to publish something. And so I've been writing since I retired in, when did I retire? 2009.
Mm-hmm. How did the idea for the Sam Dawson mysteries come about?
Well, I had a number of ideas about writing mysteries, and I needed a Wyoming protagonist that would fit the bill, and came up with the name Sam Dawson.
Kind of describe his character.
Well, Sam is an interesting guy. He has a pathological curiosity. I mean, he just has to get to the bottom of issues, has to find out the answer to a mystery, always is interested in ensuring that the antagonists in the book get their due just rewards.
Mm-hmm. Is he a photographer?
He is a photographer. He publishes tabletop or coffee table type books, large format, color, some black and white, but mostly color. And he gained some notoriety on his earlier publications were, I think, very successful. He photographs lost and abandoned cemeteries, which we have many in the state of Wyoming. And he then started doing this in other states. He's done it in Iowa and Minnesota and Nebraska, travels around photographing cemeteries.
Wow. Give us just a brief synopsis of the sixth book now in the series, Lost and Found Cafe.
In this book, Sam and his daughter, out for a father-daughter outing, find themselves embroiled, I guess is the word, in a mystery where there's murder, lots of intrigue, all the while isolated in a very rural, very isolated cafe in eastern Wyoming. The area that they find themselves isolated in this cafe, which is right on the state line, has the notoriety of being the least the closest town. There's a little town called Van Tassel in Niobrara County. It has the privilege of being the least populated town in the least populated county in the least populated state in the nation. And I chose that for a reason in this book. Because one of the characters, main characters in this book, is on the run and has been for 13 years and needed to be in an area where no one would find him.
What are some of the elements in your writing that propels the story?
Well, you know, writing mysteries, and one of the books, the one that I published before this, Yesterday Calling, was a mystery thriller. And I think that people, when they read mysteries or thrillers, need to have some break in the tension. My plots have always been formulated so that it builds tension at the end of either a scene break or a chapter.
And then you pick up on it again a few moments later when you turn the page. And that's what I attempt to do in my writing, is to get the reader to turn the page. In order to keep the reader interested, it has to be entertaining. And that's what the purpose of writing novels is.
Sure.
It's to entertain. And I like to blend a lot of fact with my fiction and address issues that need to be told, about oftentimes real issues.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can do that and tell a story and keep the reader interested, you find that they learn more and they become more sensitized. They become sympathetic, empathetic with characters, and will stick with the story better.
Can we look forward to another novel in the Sam Dawson mystery series? I know you've come off a number of
yes.
book signings that have taken up most of your summer, but...
I get that question a lot. When's the next one out?
Yeah.
You know, you just get one out, and the first question out of a fan's mouth is, when's the next one coming out? Well, I'm gathering information now. We'll continue to write, but at perhaps a slower pace.
Stephen Horn, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
That was Stephen Horn, author of the Sam Dawson mystery series, talking about his new book, Lost and Found Cafe, with Wyoming Public Media's Grady Kirkpatrick. Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcasts. And we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Those include Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, X, and Blue Sky. Thanks to Melody Edwards, this episode's audio producer, and Ivy Engel, our digital producer, and to Cody Hume, our social media manager for the show. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.